One for class. I'm excited about this morning, not necessarily because it's Easter. Well, I did see Debbie pulling a ham out of the oven this morning, so I'm excited about that too. But this is a brand new class. I don't know if I've ever taught Ezekiel before here, but I'm excited about this. I hope you guys are excited about it too. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's a kind of an unusual book, but it's got so many neat things in it, and I just quit talking about it and start getting into it. If you look at the worksheet we've got, I wanted to start with the historical perspective, and I almost hate to do this because when you're studying Ezekiel, you think, well, we should start right there in Ezekiel, but the only way to really understand what's going on with Ezekiel is to get that background, so here we are. Looking at the prophet Hosea, and when did God send prophets? What's that? When people were doing bad things. He did not have to send prophets when everybody was doing what was right. He needed to send prophets when things were messing up. And so you see, there's a lot of prophets in the Old Testament, and that's because the people did a lot of wrong stuff. So here's Hosea. In the lineup of the minor prophets, I like to joke that he's the Mexican prophet. He's the first one. That's how I remember he's the first one. He's the Mexican prophet. And then the Italian prophet, Malachi, is the last one. And so the rest of them fit in there. You got a Mexican prophet and an Italian prophet. Not really true, but it helps me remember some of the placement of where these guys are. But his work took place between 760 and 710 B.C. This is 760 years before Christ came. And there's a lot to Hosea, but this is sufficient, I think, to give us a flavor of where God was going with his work. Quote there, the Lord said to Hosea, go take yourself a wife of, and if you are familiar with Hosea, you might be able to fill in the blank without looking, but you can sure look. You can go right to the text of Hosea. Anybody know what to put there? Harlotry. Is that what somebody said? All right. Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry. What's the word flagrant mean? We use it, but we don't think about it. A lot of it, and very definitely that. There's no question about it. This is real. If you want harlotry, this is real harlotry. In other words, when you use the word flagrant. And then the word after that is forsaking. Forsaking. What do you think of the word forsaking in Scripture? Usually, probably one of the most popular forsaking passages is, do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. That doesn't mean miss an assembly every now and then. That means just give it up. Just, I'm not going there anymore. That's what the idea of forsaking the assembly is. Now, it starts with missing a few here and there and getting used to that, because when he's talking about that, he's talking about the habit. And that's exactly, we think, Marty, what are you doing in Hebrews talking about forsaking the assembly? We're supposed to be studying Ezekiel. It's the same stuff. When the writer of Hebrews was talking about a bad habit developing, that's exactly what the Israelites and the Judeans did with regard to idolatry. Well, we're going to worship God, but we're also going to add this local God to a repertoire of ones that we worship. And I don't know what's wrong with my throat this morning. Excuse me. Let me get a cough drop. Maybe that'll help. I know what it is. I didn't have any coffee this morning. Fisherman's friend. Bad habits. You develop bad habits going in the wrong direction. You start practicing bad things. And that's what happened with the Israelites long before Ezekiel came along. And Ezekiel came along to make some corrections in a different circumstance. All right, the last part of that quote is, the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah. What happened was, and you can read this in the very first part of Hosea, he went and married a woman. You remember her name? Gomer. Her name was Gomer, of all names. And they had children, and God told him to name the children names that when people heard these names, they would think of their relationship with God. And so this poor child was named Unpitied, Unloved. And that's because God wanted Israel to see his relationship with them. They are no longer pitied by him. They are no longer loved by him. The Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will have no longer have, and what goes in that blank?
Compassion.
No more compassion. And that kind of sets the tone for this. No longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I would ever blank them. And this is a hard one. Ever forgive them. My throat's letting me down this morning. We'll see if I can make it through a sermon. Doc, you might have to preach. So start looking at your notes, if you will. All right, so that's Hosea. Micah. We don't talk much about the prophet Micah, but he's a powerful prophet. 740 BC was about when he did his work. And here's a couple of quotes from him. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will, and in the text, and by the way, this is figurative language. It's not to be taken literally, but it's expressive. It's like, what was that comedian said? It's the epitome of hyperbole. That's kind of what this is, the epitome of hyperbole. Anyway, he was saying, somebody was saying he didn't know how to pronounce English words, and he said, well, listen, anyway. The mountains will melt. They will melt. There are worksheets in the back. You don't have to have one, but if you want one, I wanted you to know they got them back there. Yes. Ah, excellent. Good work, Judy. And we are on the second check mark where it says Micah. We're talking about Micah's quote. The mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be split like wax before the fire, like water poured down a steep place. All this is for the blank of Jacob. Are you looking at the text? The text has the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. He's not finished yet. But you're starting to get a flavor, perhaps, of what God was trying to get across to the nations because of their idolatry, their flagrant harlotry, which is how he describes this idolatry. And it wasn't just idolatry, but when they would get in trouble, they would seek help from the nations surrounding them rather than going to God. There were a lot of problems with the attitude of Israel towards God. So the next part of that quote is this. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not? What would you put in that blank? Samaria. Where was Samaria? Well, that was part of what was then Israel. And you may understand there were two parts to Israel by this time. When Solomon died, his son Rehoboam was supposed to take the throne. But he decided that he would be harder on the people than his dad was, and so the nation split. And a servant of Solomon's named Jeroboam took the 10 northern tribes, and in order to keep them from going back to Jerusalem, he established idolatrous worship in the south part of the 10 northern tribes and the north part of the 10 northern tribes. And the people did not say, oh, we're not going to do that. We're going to go to Jerusalem and worship the true and living God. They fell into it, and so there became two nations rather than one nation of Israel. There was the southern part, which came to be called Judah, and then there was the 10 northern tribes called Israel. Samaria is in Israel. the 10 northern tribes, and it's the capital. What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem of all places? And when he says high place, what was the high place known for? That's where you built your idols. That's where you built your altars. That's where you put the things that you used to worship the idol gods of the area. And so when he mentioned high place, he's talking about a place where you worship idols. I'll make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. I'll pour her stones down into the valley, and I will lay bare her foundations. All of her blanks will be smashed. All of her idols. And these weren't American idols from the TV show. It's sitting about playing guitars and singing. All of her idols will be smashed. All of her earnings will be burned with fire. And all of her blanks I will make desolate. Similar to idols, but this is images. Images. What was the first commandment? Have no other gods before me. And then next to that, do not make any graven images. Which is exactly what Aaron and the Israelites did when Moses didn't come down off the mountain. It's like, really? Do you read this stuff and go, what? They did what? Of course, we're a lot smarter than that today. All of her images I will make desolate, for she collected them from a blank's earnings. We're back to what Hosea was talking about. She collected them from a harlot's earnings. And to the earnings of a harlot they will return. Now this isn't God using his prophets to correct heathen, pagan, foreign nations. This is God using his prophets to correct his own people who are becoming heathen and pagan, or who have become heathen and pagan. Right after that second quote from Micah, it says, neither Israel nor Judah stayed faithful to God, but rather chose to serve idols and the surrounding nations. That's what you would put there. They served idols, but they also served the nations. It's kind of like it is today. Anybody but God, anything but God. When you look out in the world, you'll find people following almost everything and anything except God. Just don't want to have to submit to God. It's interesting. All right, number one, down at the bottom. In 722 BC, 722 years before Christ was born, that's the idea of that BC, God brought the nation of, anybody know? Assyria. The nation of Assyria against Israel. They were a huge, powerful nation up to the north, modern day Iraq and Iran. Was their idolatry, and they were taken away into captivity, and they didn't come back. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 7. Going to do a little reading this morning. I need somebody to get chapter 7, 18 to 25. Who would like to read that? Anybody? I know it's Sunday morning and you're tired and you had to get up early and hunt eggs and all that. All right, Doc's got 18 to 25 in chapter 7, and then I need somebody to take the first 8 verses of chapter 8. Who would like to do that? Anybody who knows how to read the English language is qualified to do that. All right, I'll read. Okay, Judy will do it. So Doc and Judy, go ahead.
And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly, that is, in the farthest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee, that is, in the land of Assyria, they will come, and all of them will rest in the desolate valleys and in the clefts of the rocks, and on all thorns and in all pastures. In the same day, the Lord will shave with a hired razor with those from beyond the river with the king of Assyria, and the head and the hair of the legs will also be removed, the beard. It shall be in the day that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, so it shall be from the abundance of milk they give, that they will eat curds, for curds and honey everyone will eat who is left in the land. And it shall happen in that day that wherever there could be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it will be for briars and thorns. With arrows and bows, men will come there, because all the land will become briars and thorns. And to any hill which could be dug with the hoe, you will not go there for fear of briars and thorns. But it will become a range for oxen and a place for sheep to run.
Chapter 8, verse 1.
Then the Lord said to me, take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters, Mahir Shalal Hash Oz. And I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Zebadiah. So I approached the prophetesses, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And then the Lord said to me, Name him, Mahir Shalal Hashbaz. And before the boy knows how to cry out, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoils of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. Again, the Lord spoke to me further, saying, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah, therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates River, that is, the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and then it will sweep on into Judah and will overflow and pass through, and it will reach as far as the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the expanse of your land, Emmanuel.
All right. Boy, pretty colorful language to describe what's going to go on. Going to whistle for the fly, and what else?
Bee.
The bee. Going to whistle for the fly and for the bee. He's talking about in figurative language the king of Assyria. He's coming. I am bringing him, God says. He's whistling for, hey, get out of here. I need you. Need you to punish my people for their sin. So that's what's going to happen. And in chapter 8, we're seeing similarly what God was doing through Hosea. God said to Hosea, you go take a wife of harlotry and have children. We're going to name your kids things that will be lessons to the Israelites, those poor kids. But that's what God did through Hosea. He's doing similarly through Isaiah, except Isaiah didn't have to go marry a harlot. He already had a wife, so he goes in to the prophetess and she conceives. And what's this poor child's name? Longest name in the Bible, Mahir Shalal Hashbaz. I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce it, but that's how I pronounce it. What does the name mean? It's right there in the text. Look at verse 1 of chapter 8.
Swift is the booty, speedy is
the prey. That's it. Swift is the booty.
What if they called him Swifty?
Might have. Yeah, probably for short. Yeah. I don't know how that would work out in Hebrew, but... But these names, when people would say them, remember that kid? What was his name? Well, don't forget his name. Mahir Shalal Hashbaz. Swift is the booty, and swift is the booty, speedy is the prey, and Israel is the prey. That's the picture that God is giving. And I'm making this happen. I'm calling for the king of Assyria to come. Now, these aren't isolated passages. These are just representative passages. When you read through Isaiah, you see this same idea coming up and up and up all the time. Same with other prophets. But always mixed in with those messages are messages of hope. There's always a message of hope for those who are willing to be faithful to God in spite of the present culture, which those passages have always been encouraging to me, because the culture doesn't usually go in the right direction. I'm encouraged right now because I'm seeing quite a bit of turnaround. While there's a lot of things to be upset about in our culture, there are also a lot of things to rejoice over. People are looking for truth. A lot of our young people on college campuses are attending Christian preaching sessions, and they're even being baptized. I don't know all the details of all they're being taught about all of that, but I'm grateful to see that there is some kind of return to people paying attention to God and paying homage to Him. I don't want to second guess any of that. What's that?
In the last week, I've heard President Trump twice read from the Bible.
Yes, and give an Easter message encouraging Americans to be mindful of the fact that Christ rose on it. Yeah, and he refers to Him as our Lord and Savior. Obviously, I don't know Him personally. I'm not real close to know what that is all about in His mind. But to hear a president say that, after what we've been through in the last several decades of humanism and secularism, this is fantastic. So we'll rejoice in that while we can. All right, that was number one. Number two, Judah failed to learn from the divine, what would you call that when God brings Assyria on Israel? Judgment, the divine judgment. Judah failed to learn from the divine judgment against Israel, and so eventually suffered similarly in 606 BC when God brought, who knows what nation God brought on Judah. It wasn't the Assyrians this time, the Babylonians, or sometimes called the Chaldeans. They were brought on Judah in 606. So let's read from Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 5 through 11. That's probably everybody's favorite minor prophet. It's because he sounds like tobacco. Habakkuk 1, 5 through 11. Anybody want to read that? All right, Belinda.
Look among the nations and watch, utterly astounded. For I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you. For indeed I am raising up the cauldrons of a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity receive them from themselves. Their horses, the horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their charges charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastes to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes, and his transgresses, he commits offense, ascribing this power to his God.
All right. Thank you, Belinda. Look what he says in verse 5. Observe, be astonished, wonder. I'm doing something in your days that you wouldn't believe if you were told. What's he going to do? Next verse tells you. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. Who are the Chaldeans? Well, Assyria was a mighty nation that overwhelmed Israel, the 10 northern tribes. Here's a nation coming behind them that's overwhelmed the Assyrians, and now I'm bringing them on Babylon. And that's how it always was. You can look through history, and one nation arose and had great power for a while, and then before you know it, another nation arises with greater power, wipes them out. It's like Daniel chapter 2. By the way, where was Daniel When we read about Daniel, he was in Babylon. He was in Babylon. Where is Ezekiel? He's in Babylon. Daniel was an exile. Ezekiel was an exile. So we've got these guys in these nations still reporting what God is doing and what God will do. And in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had a dream. Daniel interpreted that dream to be four nations. Babylon was the first nation. After Babylon would come another nation. Who conquered Babylon? The Persians, the Medo-Persians. Who conquered the Medo-Persians eventually? Alexander the Great with the Greeks. Who conquered the Greeks eventually? The Romans. It's always going to be somebody else coming down the pike and going to be stronger and better than you. And this is God, because when Assyria fell to Babylon, you can read in the prophets that that was God's judgment against Assyria for doing what they did to Israel. And you might be going, wait a minute, didn't God call Assyria? Yes, he did. Just like God called Pharaoh in Pharaoh's day, and Pharaoh did what he did and was punished for it. God didn't call him to be evil or to do evil, but he used Pharaoh, and so God uses nations. He brings nations up, and he brings nations down. As Daniel said in Daniel chapter 4, he puts the lowliest of men in high offices. And when you read history, you'll find out that that's pretty accurate. A lot of guys that, and people just revel in doing this. Anybody that you respect in history, they'll dig and they'll find some dirt on him, and then they'll want to, oh, we want to tell you the bad stuff about Abraham Lincoln, or the dark things, the dark side of George Washington. It's like the internet is just covered over with this stuff, and I'd just like to go smack some people. I think that would be the Christian thing to do in some of these cases. Just hush. God's always teaching us, if there's anything good, dwell on that. I'm going to tell you some history that's hard to hear, but I want you to know this is all just. This is justice. This is me doing what has to be done. It's the same, as I was reading this, this is the same conversation I had with my children when they misbehaved. All right, go in the bathroom, wait for me. They go in the bathroom, and a couple times we forgot they were in there. Anyway, cinnamon, and then you go in. What do you say when you go in there when you're trying to train and teach your children? Do you know what you did wrong? What do you think I'm supposed to do about this? I'm your dad. How can you do better? How do you think you should be punished? It's the same conversation that God is having with his people over and over and over, because they're doing all the same evil stuff over and over and over. And I read this and I think, how hard would it have been to just be godly? What did God require? That's what Micah asks. But does he want all these sacrifices? He doesn't really want sacrifices. He wants you to do justly, to love people, to care about what's right. That's all God wanted, and that's what he expressed through his prophets. And that's what he taught us through Jesus. Just do what's right. But there's always another way to go that seems more appealing to us. So, all right, what are we looking at here? Where are we? We're in Habakkuk. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. That's chapter 1, verse 6. Dreaded and feared, verse 7, their justice and authority originate within themselves. Nobody's going to tell them what's right and wrong. They're going to do what they want. Their horses are swifter than leopards, keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swooping down to devour. And then he talks about I missed that. I didn't talk about that with regard to the water coming in like a flood. How high did the water come? Came up to the neck. Anybody ever been in a flood and you're seeing the flood come and you just can't stop it? Water's so powerful. And that's how God was imaging through his prophets the coming of the Babylonians on Judah. Coming in like a flood. All right, let's go to number 3. There were 3 deportations. Deportations. You think Ezekiel's timely? What's happening right now in our country? It's like the opposite. It's deportations, but our government is trying to round up people who came here illegally and send them back to where they came from, especially those who didn't come here to try to better their lives. Talking about people who came here to do us harm. Rounding those up, sending them back to where they came from. In this case, with Judah, they're being deported to a foreign nation. They're taking them from their home and taking them to a foreign nation. And this is what nations would do when they would conquer another country. You go into another country, you conquer it, and you say, okay, who have they got there that's educated? Who knows how to do good things? Who's there that could be a resource for us? And it's always been the same. Our space program, do you know who was one of the leading men in our space program after World War II? A fellow by the name of Wernher von Braun. I think that was his name. What was he famous for? Do you remember the V-2 rockets that the Germans fired at England? That was his baby. He was a scientist, and he figured out how to do those kinds of things. And so after the war, we said, hey, where is that guy? We need him on our space program. What? He was a German engineer. What's that? Yeah, he was an enemy. But that's the way it works. You take the people who know how to do things, and you incorporate them into your culture, which is exactly what happened with Daniel and who else? Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. And there's more to this than just the way countries operate. It's the providence of God. You're going into exile, Daniel. Oh, no, what's going to happen? Hey, I'm going to put you second in charge of the nation. What? I'm going to be a captive carried into exile by force, and you're going to put me in command of... Yeah, that's the way it works. That's the way God works all the time. He does things. Joseph, do you think for 1 minute when Joseph's brothers threw him into that pit that he was thinking, oh, if no problem, it won't be long. I'll be second in command of Egypt. Yeah, and I'll save your lives. It's just when you read this stuff and you think, well, God is using his people all the time to do fantastic things. They're not necessarily the things that those people would have chosen to do. But if you could bring Daniel back today and ask him, Daniel, what do you think about being exiled to Babylon? What do you think he would say? I'm confident he would say, it worked out great. It was the will of the Lord. And when I followed through with the will of the Lord, everything happened the way it was supposed to. Because when he was in captivity, when he was in Babylon, the only things people could find fault in him for was his dedication to God. That was his mindset. God's always looking for people like that. That's what Jesus said to the Samaritan woman. God is seeking those who will worship him. How? In spirit and in truth. That's what Jesus said to her. That wasn't news then. It's always been that way. God was looking for those people in the days of Ezekiel and in the days of Hosea and in the days of Isaiah and Micah. But not many of them were showing up. Some did. And God always promised there's going to be a remnant. You'll see that throughout the book of Ezekiel, this idea of a remnant, going to save a remnant. We'll read through Jeremiah, where God sent a letter through Jeremiah to the exiles and said, when you get there, build yourself a house, plant a garden, have your kids get married, but not to the heathens, marry in with the exiles, because I'm bringing you back in 70 years. That was God's promise, and he fulfilled it. And who did he fulfill it through? By the way? You may remember? A heathen, pagan, Persian king by the name of Cyrus, whom God's prophet identified by name long before it happened. So God was still using kings, people in authority, to do his will. And sometimes it was awful stuff, and sometimes it was really good stuff. And I might be getting ahead of myself, but I don't mean to too much. Okay, we're down at the bottom of the first page there on number 3 still. There were 3 deportations of Judeans by the Babylonians. And I put in parentheses the Chaldeans because it's the same bunch. And I put the numbers there, the dates, 606, 597, and 586. Now, if you do some research, you'll find there's a little discrepancy about the exact dating of these deportations, but these numbers are pretty close, and right now it's not going to make a whole lot of difference one way or the other if we're off a year or two. It's just that there were three deportations. A, the initial deportation in 606 B.C. of the brightest and best, which included, now who are you going to put down in those four blanks? Daniel, Shadrach, you have to figure out how to spell it. Meshach and Abednego, those four Hebrew young men were sent into exile in the first deportation. Come on now. B, a second deportation. We're on the back side of this worksheet. How about that? Second deportation in 597, which included Ezekiel. Ezekiel went in the second deportation. This is also when King Jehoiachin's exile began. And this was woefully foretold by Jeremiah at chapter 22, 24 to 23, to chapter 23, verse 8. And we may look at that later. We're running out of time this morning, so we won't look at that right now. But there was a promise of an eventual return to live on their own soil with that exile. And then a third deportation took place in 586. And this is when the walls of blank were breached. What city do you suppose would be in view there? Jerusalem. This is the city where God put his name, but the people had become so faithless that God said, all right, for a time, I'm going to let Jerusalem go under. The walls are going to be breached, and then the city, including the blank, was burned. Temple. This is before they had synagogues, and this would lead to the development of the synagogue. So Jerusalem was taken, captured. What was happening during these three deportations? Let me try to make this clear. When Babylon came in at 606, the Judeans were forced to capitulate. And so Nebuchadnezzar taxed them. They kept their king. And then he took some deportees and left. And what do the Jewish people do? They eventually revolt against Nebuchadnezzar's authority. And so he sends another army down there to quell that revolt. Take some more deportees. And then they finally revolt the third time. He comes back. Okay, this is had enough of this. Three times they breached the city walls, burn the city, burn the temple, and take what's left of the people into captivity. And those that were left, along with those in Israel, become Samaritans. There's a lot of, it's all kind of vague and not really clear, but it's all looking like this. None of this was the way God wanted it to be. It's just the way it had to be because of their misbehavior. All right, what the text tells us about Ezekiel himself. Oh, we're in the text of Ezekiel. How about that? Did you think it would happen? Somebody read the first three verses for us, please. Anybody want that? Maybe y'all do it to save time. It came about in the 30th year. In what year? 30th year. On the fifth day of the fourth month, while I was by the river Chebar among the exiles, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest. What was he? He was a priest, son of Buzi. What an unfortunate name. In the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar, and there the hand of the Lord came upon him. That's just the first three verses. So what do we learn about Ezekiel from these first three verses? 30th year likely refers to his age. And there's a clue for that in the next part. B, he was a priest. Son of a priest. That's the way it always worked out. That's how you got that work, that job. and as such would normally have begun his ministry in his 30th year. This is according to Numbers chapter 4. God said when a man becomes 30 years old, that's when he will begin his priesthood. By the way, how old was Jesus about when he gathered his 12 apostles and began his ministry? 30. He was about 30 years old. So it all figures. And you look at those passages, those texts in Numbers chapter 4, it talks about the 30th year. When did a priest retire? When he was 50. So a priest does his priestly work for 20 years, and then he retires. C, he was among the Judean blanks in Babylon. Exiles is what you put there. He was among the exiles, people who were exiled to Babylon. D, God began sending Ezekiel visions in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's exile, which would be about 592 BC, which is why he is placed among the second deportation. There were three deportations. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they went in the first deportation. Ezekiel almost certainly went in the second deportation, 597. Okay, the last two bullet points there. Ezekiel's presence, the fact that he was there among them, among the exiles, and the prophecies God gives him are further evidence that while God has arranged for this exile to take place, he has not abandoned his people. In the circumstances, you might have thought, oh, we've been abandoned. But he says, I have not abandoned you. Just like when you have to punish your children for misbehavior, what do you want to reassure them about when it's over? That you still love them. You hug them, you hold them. And that's the way God does it. The last bullet point. See also Jeremiah 29, 1 through 14, and hear the famous passage. I really wanted to read this. But you read it, please, because we're out of time. A famous passage in its context. Fill the word context into that blank. Showing God's intentions for a restoration. You're going off into exile, but I'm bringing you back. This is the punishment. The just punishment that he was compelled to bring on them for their flagrant idolatry. Flagrant harlotry, spiritually speaking. All right. Anybody got any questions? Next week we'll get more into the text, and everybody wants to know what the seraphim and the cherubim look like. So I'm going to have you draw pictures next week. So bring crayons.